Support for this Guardian podcast comes from Squarespace, providing creative tools that help you bring your ideas to life. Squarespace offers free domain names, customizable designs, and 24/7 support. Go to squarespace.com and use the offer code Guardian to get 10% off.
Hello, this is Politics Weekly. I'm Tom Clark. This week seems to be payback time for The Guardian as a string of national newspapers and backbench MPs queue up to accuse the paper of jeopardising Britain's national security.
Can we have a full and transparent assessment about whether The Guardian's involvement in the Snowden affair has damaged Britain's national security?
As an inquiry was announced over the extent and scale of mass surveillance by Britain's spies, we'll chew over the Edward Snowden leaks and ask whether they're being used to sabotage regulation of the press post-Leveson. Plus, with the US having agreed to a deal to raise its debt ceiling after 16 days of government shutdown, we'll look at what the whole palaver says about US credibility in the eyes of the world. Parliament's Intelligence and Security Committee will carry out a major inquiry in public into the work done by GCHQ, MI5 and MI6. The ISC chair, Sir Malcolm Rifkin, said there's a balance to be found between our individual right to privacy and our collective right to security. A big inquiry into surveillance then. But the Prime Minister was yesterday talking about an inquiry into The Guardian instead for the way that it's reported on this stuff. Confusing, isn't it? So let's take a step back and remind ourselves about what the main revelations were. Our colleague James Ball is in New York.
Since June, The Guardian's been publishing a series of revelations about the activities of America's National Security Agency and the UK's equivalent GCHQ. These all come from a trove of documents leaked by a whistleblower, a 29-year-old contractor called Edward Snowden, who worked for a private company who did deals for the NSA. And there have been a whole string of stories, but the key themes that have come out there is that spying isn't something that these agencies do on a small scale anymore. They don't just track the people they're interested in. They have huge programs that spy essentially on all of us. In America, people's phone records, who they call, when, for how long, are kept for everybody through court-ordered mass surveillance. The UK runs a huge network of internet taps, where the huge fibre optic cables that cross the Atlantic land in the UK. GCHQ sucks up all of this data and keeps it for up to a month. So the whole nature of privacy and of what the state has to do to keep us safe changes, and all of this happened in private. Even cabinet ministers in the UK have said that they had no idea this went on. The other sort of key theme that came out was that the NSA and GCHQ have worked to really undermine encryption. Now, that sounds like some obscure thing, but it's actually what underpins everything that keeps us safe online. It's what keeps your email account private. It's what keeps Facebook secure. It's when you put in your bank details or when you fill in all of your personal information on an insurance form. Encryption is what keeps that safe. And our spy agencies have deliberately made that less secure for all of us. Now, it might be that they would say the trade-off is worth it, but essentially what these revelations have done is start a debate around the world, maybe less in the UK, about the legitimacy and the scope of what these agencies do, really for the first time. The last element, really, is also that during the course of the story, The Guardian, in particular, has come under huge pressure from the government. In July, it was asked, and eventually did, to destroy material held in its basement, but it had said that there were copies already with the New York Times and with ProPublica, a US not-profit newsroom. Also, the reporter who's led most of this coverage for The Guardian, Glenn Greenwald, his partner was detained at Heathrow under the Terrorism Act, and there's now an ongoing legal challenge as to whether that was legitimate or not.
So that's the background in terms of the summer's big revelations in The Guardian about the NSA and the modern means of state surveillance. But joining me now is Alan Travis, who's our Home Affairs editor. Alan, if we just take a step back, Does this argument about state surveillance tie in with the idea that we heard about both in the dying days of the Labour government and earlier on in this coalition of the so-called Snoopers Charter?
A year ago, Theresa May brought forward her draft Communications Data Bill, also known as the Snoopers Charter, which would give the security services and the police the power to require private companies to store everybody's metadata stroke communications data for up to 12 months for immediate access.
That's details of who you've been ringing and when sort of thing.
Yes, and indeed what tweets you sent people, what social media interactions you've had, a wealth of personal details about your online life and internet use. And in making the case for that bill, the central foundation stone was the argument that current ability of the police and security services to access that data was deteriorating as technology developed and people moved away from simple having phone calls and bills, which itemized phone calls or texts, and moved into areas which were no longer billed by companies and therefore the details weren't held, such as your social media use. And they said there was a 25% capability gap, which was growing all the time and could be 33%. By 2018. Now, there was a committee of Parliament, scrutiny committee of joint MPs and peers. This committee sat for 5 months and took evidence on the subject of justifying the Snoopers Charter. And again and again, including Lord Armstrong himself, pressed security chiefs on the nature of this capability gap. And not once, anywhere during that 5 months deliberations, including two private sessions, did the Home Office senior officials see fit to mention anything about the capability of GCHQ to conduct its temporal operation of scooping up everybody's social media and internet use data. And that has sparked great anger this week from the former chairman of that committee, Lord Blencathra, David McLean, and also Nick Brown, who are former Labour cabinet minister, who say they feel they were misled and feel quite angry about that.
OK, so where are we now with the communications data bill? I mean, from one point of view, it sounds like they're already doing most of what that was going to license anyway.
Possibly some of it, yes, indeed. But Theresa May said at the Home Affairs Select Committee this week, an important statement she made when she said that she did not think of any of the disclosures by Snowden and The Guardian about the capability of GCHQ changed the case for the Communications Data Bill. She's still very keen on it and thinks it's needed. When she was repeatedly pressed by Labour and Lib Dem MPs on that committee as for a full parliamentary debate on the nature of oversight of the security services and intelligence services, she said that these issues had all been dealt with in the Justice and Security Act, which set up secret courts last year, and there was no need to revisit these questions. But they raised very, very large questions about what sort of oversight of secret projects, which they weren't willing to tell Parliament about, can possibly exist.
Are there any bright ideas for how would you have proper scrutiny of surveillance? Because, of course, spies say that they of necessity have to operate in a fairly secretive manner.
The privacy and civil rights groups came up with a whole renew of possible ways of strengthening surveillance oversight this week. Yvette Cooper repeated and renewed her call the weekend. She thinks there should be at least a unification of all these different commissioners and a strengthening of the Intelligence and Security Committee, both in terms of staff and reach and also disclosure. And I think there is a consensus developing around strengthening the oversight in that sense. It's quite interesting that when Nick Clegg vetoed the draft communications data bill at the Queen's speech last autumn and sent Theresa May back to the drawing board, she actually did rewrite the entire bill, and we understand redrafted it in a way that considerably proposed massive strengthening of the oversight under Ripper of the work of surveillance services, and that in order to try and get her Snoopers Charter through, she was prepared to concede much stronger oversight. So I think in that sense, a psychological moment may have already been passed within Whitehall.
OK, so Alan Travis there, and joining me in the studio we have The Guardian's comment writer Martin Kettle, leader writer Anne Perkins, and columnist Jonathan Friedland. Jonathan, an inquiry into state surveillance or an inquiry into The Guardian, which seemed to be the suggestion at Prime Minister's questions. Do you think we're going to end up getting both?
It could be both, and it could fall on these lines, because the Keith Vaz and his Home Affairs Committee investigation does seem, at least in just what's been said so far, to have just high up on its list an investigation into what The Guardian have done. He's going to fit it into a rolling inquiry into counter-terrorism. And so the suggestion from backbench Tory MPs, including actually Liam Fox, in Prime Minister's Questions, that The Guardian is somehow aiding and abetting those who pose a threat to this country. So that has gone, if you like, to Keith Vaz's address. Whereas the language around the Rifkin announcement about the ISC, the Intelligence Security Committee inquiry, is more hopeful, if you like, from a Guardian point of view, because it seemed to suggest he was actually going to look at the content and the substance of the revelations that have been aired by The Guardian, along with partners around the world, that there is a real case to answer here, that the NSA and GCHQ are essentially out of control and monitoring all of us, rather than just those who pose a threat. And he, just in the you know, quotes we've got about what the way he's going to set up this inquiry, it does sound as if it's that case he's looking to answer. So I don't think The Guardian won't come up in that inquiry, and there's certainly grounds to fear that that could just, both of them could end up just beating up on The Guardian. But so far, the indications are that's the real arena for that would be Vaz's committee, and the Rifkin inquiry may be more earnestly into the substance of these revelations.
And Anne, do you think if the ISC really does get its teeth into stuff that it sounds like it had previously missed, doesn't the point about The Guardian slightly fall away? Because then the great and the good of that committee is saying there is a public interest issue here to look at.
Yeah, I mean, I think these are perilous times, but I think it could work ultimately in The Guardian's favour. I think the difficult thing about the ISC is that it's not operated so far in a terrifically confidence-inducing manner, and it seems to lack a real appetite for challenge. And because it hears everything in private or in secret, and because of this extraordinary power that the securocrats have to persuade people that they can't be challenged, one has to be a little sceptical about quite how far and effective it'll be.
I mean, I suppose without knowing in advance about the PRISM programme or whatever, even if they were a very thorough committee, it's quite hard to say, have you got a PRISM programme?
In the unknown unknowns, exactly, and they're not going to volunteer information. There's this long history of everything having to be found by breaching secrets because there is no record. And it's true in the States too, I think, to a considerable extent. They don't, their security services don't tool up at Congress and announce new programmes, do they?
Well, I'm sure they don't, Martin, but do you think that if there is a big problem here with this committee, the Intelligence Security Committee, which works, I think, a bit differently from other parliamentary committees, doesn't it? Do you think that's an inherent thing, that it's just they're fumbling in the dark, or do you think it's something to do with the way the committee's set up and its rules?
It's a bit of both, I think. I think this is all, you know, the cliche of the moment, a work in progress. We've moved over the last 20 years from having absolutely no accountability and oversight in these matters at all. You couldn't even say these things existed. Mm. And that was the case really right up until the late years of Mrs. Thatcher, to a situation where we've got an uneven beginning of a process of accountability. And it seems to me what's happening now fits into that process. It doesn't quite fit with the committee structure as it exists, but these matters are now out there on the table, and they're going to be examined and debated, perhaps not in exactly the way that The Guardian would ideally like, but nevertheless in important ways. It's important to remember that up to about a month ago, The Guardian was complaining in its editorials that nobody in British public life was taking any interest in any of these things which the paper's been reporting on, and that there was a kind of vast sort of silence and indifference within the British body politic, which contrasted with the situation in America, where there are three pieces of congressional legislation under consideration, where the president himself has said it's a legitimate area for public debate. And Hillary Clinton, who was in town here a few days ago, said precisely the same. Obviously, these are hugely difficult problems, genuinely difficult problems. And, you know, what The Guardian is walking a tightrope, because there are serious issues of national security involved at the heart of this as well, as well as the civil liberties issues. But nevertheless, I think I take a generally positive view of what's happening, because even though The Guardian may get kicked around, I think in the end, we're getting a debate about where the proper limits between civil liberty and national security come with modern technology. And that's a good thing.
On that point, I mean, it would be an irony, wouldn't it, for Andrew Parker, the head of MI5, who made this speech, really laying into the Guardian, and especially the speech actually was fairly mild, but in his briefing, or in the briefing that preceded the speech, attacking the Guardian, it would be ironic if it was out of that, Martin's absolutely right. Before then, there was complete silence on this subject, and then suddenly this onslaught on the Guardian, branding us traitors, etc., has brought it out, and finally we've got that debate, and it would be perhaps not what he intended, but there is finally that debate. I think on the point about the committee, that you know, the mechanism is in some ways, it isn't perfect. It's an odd kind of committee, nine people, and
does the Prime Minister appoint them?
It was initially appointed by the Prime Minister to report to the Prime Minister, but consisting of parliamentarians. It now has a status within Parliament, which it didn't have before, which Malcolm Rifkin, to do him justice, pressed for it to have, and that was part of the legislation.
So the mechanism is there, but as always with these things, it comes down to the people, and Martin mentions Malcolm Rifkin, and there is, it's an interesting challenge for him. I mean, you know, on the one hand, there are people in the civil liberties universe who think, well, he's a former foreign secretary, former defence secretary, he's right in bed with and thick with the spooks, he's the last person to be able to ask tough questions. On the other hand, he has the experience and qualifications to do it. So it's worth casting an eye down those, as I've done, to look at who those nine people are, because the mechanism's there in a way, it's neutral, it's worth thinking, what will they do with it? So for Labour, there's Hazel Blears. You know, is she somebody who can ask tough questions of the security services? I don't know. For the ranking Lib Dem is Min Campbell. I think we could expect he could ask some tough questions. He's not in perfect health at the moment, so that's a question. And then Rifkind himself. And there are a few others on there too. So it's up to them. They could ask some really tough questions, and they don't need, actually, any more than it's already been inserted into the public domain by The Guardian and others. I mean, there is plenty to ask on just with what's already there. You know, you start with the very first story, that PowerPoint about the PRISM technology, which we published. And you could just say to those people, how is this justified? What's the extent of it? What's the British involvement with it? And that would, you would find out a lot doing that.
But it's such a huge kind of technical and philosophical challenge to try and define what the best result would look like. And we know it's easy to say there should be pre-authorisation, but how do you define the parameters? Because the whole point of metadata is that you can track patterns across vast amounts of traffic. How do you decide what constitutes a legitimate amount of traffic, and at what point are you breaching everybody's individual human right to privacy? I think it's always going to be a question of a balance between rival forces. And in a way, it seems to me that one of the really good and useful things we've done is exert that backward pressure on the onward march of the securocracy, which just has to be done sort of once every 5 or 10 years.
Yes, it is conceivable. You could have this open debate and conclude at the end that we do need to do this, that we need the entire haystack to find those occasional needles. Mm. We may decide to do that. But I think if I was a member of that committee, of all the Guardian revelations, in a way, the one I would find most shocking is the one that didn't come via Edward Snowden, but Chris Hune's article for our own paper that says, I sat in the cabinet, I was on the National Security Council, and I didn't even know this existed. Mm. And that, I think, if you're a member of parliament with any kind of self-respect, or a former minister, and a lot of them are, that one must be shocking and that must be alarming. And I just wonder if that's the angle that may actually put a bit of sort of friction when they have those security chiefs there to say, if you're Hazel Blears, did you keep this from me when I was in the Home Office? If you're Rifkin, did you keep this from me when I was Foreign Secretary? So I think that could give a bit of edge to those hearings.
The countervailing thing, though, Martin, is that most of the, I don't know, the British politicians you talk to seem to think most people don't really care. Now, it could be that politicians are older than average and don't realise how much of people's lives they live online now. But is it just a British thing that we're not as bothered about being spied on as, say, the Americans?
Well, I think it depends what question you ask people, and it depends how you frame the debate, as in so many other things. And, you know, I don't think the British people are that much different from other people. And, you know, if you look across only the Channel, never mind the Atlantic, the issues of surveillance and the issues of metadata collection have been really big issues. Big issue in the German election. It's a big issue in the Netherlands and in Belgium, you know, a country to which we pay absolutely no attention whatever at any time. Belgium is a really big issue. It's threatening the Belgian government that the Americans spied on Belgian government traffic. So if you ask the question, you know, do you think that the government should be able to study all the data of your communications and what you're looking at on the internet? I think most people say no. They shouldn't. But on the other hand, do you think that it's important that the state protects you from people who want to blow you up in the bus or on the train or on the tube or in the Channel Tunnel? You bet they'll say yes. So, I mean, those things have got to be balanced out. And that's really what this process is all about. The big reality today is that the security threat to this country comes from small secret groups who live, some of them, in this country, and maybe even loners, self-starters, as they're called in the trade, you know, who are really difficult to spot. Our spies don't exist now, you know, to watch what's happening to the German army or the Russian army or the French army or whoever. It's not about sort of people in uniform being moved around in large battalions and whether they're going to threaten our borders. It's about blokes in bedsits online all the time.
Which means anything is potentially of interest.
And therefore, you know, that's why it's a real question. And one shouldn't just dismiss it as a kind of Orwellian fantasy. There is a real issue there.
But we're all sounding quite animated about this, but it hasn't even, like, I think of the previous Guardian story on phone hacking, which really did grip, you know, the BBC picked it up in a big way. Lots of parliamentarians did. Johnny's made the suggestion that maybe Andrew Parker's speech has changed things a little bit, but it doesn't feel like the politicians think that this is a big issue, does it, as far as their constituents go?
I think there are lots of factors at play. I mean, there's the, well, didn't we know that anyway thing, you know, well, yes, but particularly since one or two of our early stories were in the context of the target, unsurprising, although the nature of the surveillance was highly sophisticated. But I disagree with Martin. I think perhaps we do have, we are a bit more relaxed about state activities in this area, which may be down to our recent history. I think the British, even so far as one can make sweeping generalisations, tend to be kind of, on the whole, uninterested in challenging authority as long as they're relatively comfortably off. It's just a very complicated subject and it's very hard. The trouble with the news coverage of it or the spread of it among newspapers was that we had an exclusive source and it was hard for newspapers to find their own angle in on it.
Right, yes. I would agree with that. And I think when you said about phone hacking, it took a very long time for anybody to talk about that except
that's
us.
That's true. Yeah. Yeah. For years we were treated as...
As if it was cranky and we were outside, off the reservation, and the BBC didn't get into it till much later. I think this cultural point is interesting. I mean, the contrast between us and the Americans is really huge, where they just the idea of the intrusive state is common to both right and left. And I was speaking to a Guardian colleague who's based now in the United States who just said, coming back here, they found themselves saying, where are the libertarians? You know, that they're in Congress among Democrats and among Republicans, there are people who, beyond left and right, will just take exception to government intrusion. And I think Martin's absolutely right to mention Europe here, because the Germans have had a huge reaction to this. It was new to me about Belgium, but the Germans saw this as being in that context of the Stasi and lives of others and being monitored, and we know all that stuff. We don't have, in a way, an equivalent experience to that, where the idea of being listened in on is immediately hit some kind of deep chord in the folk memory. I don't think we have that, and so maybe it doesn't offend us in quite the same way.
I think another factor that needs to be threaded into this is the post-Leveson furore that's going on within the press.
Yes.
And so that every revelation that comes from The Guardian is tarnished in the eyes of the Daily Mail by the fact it comes from a paper which is prepared to see some form of post-Leveson change to the structure of the newspaper industry. And so there is a lot of kind of dog-eat-dog element in this whole argument. And just to connect what I've just said to what Anne said. I mean, I think the fact that we don't have a debate is partly down to the fact that we have such a poor press. We think we have a free press, but we have a poor press, which is, you know, which doesn't investigate big, serious questions and debate them from the point of view of a kind of civic issue about libertarian values of the kind that Johnny is talking about. American newspapers and news organizations are much more free and happy to exchange thoughts on things of this kind. So, you know, it is a cultural thing. I accept Anne's point on that.
Let's draw a line under spying now and turn to the United States, where, whether or not the press is better, the discourse hasn't been entirely healthy of late. Congress passed legislation last night to save the country from the brink of debt default, bringing 16 days of government shutdown to an end and pulling financial markets back from the edge. Jonathan, it's been a protracted, messy struggle affecting everything from national parks to airports as the government's been unable to pay its bills. What's it achieved? Has anything changed as a result of all this grandstanding?
Well, just at the most basic level, they've bought themselves some time. These decisions won't come back, aren't revisited till the new year. The funding for the government itself runs through till middle of January, January the 15th. And this issue of the debt ceiling, which was the one that got the rest of the world most anxious because a US government default on its debts would trigger financial crisis around the world, that is going to come right back on February the 7th. So this has just bought some time. It's a window. And now what you wonder is what goes on inside the Republican Party. Or what's been played out on a world stage is in some ways a civil war inside the Republican Party, where a Tea Party faction is breaking the norms that have governed and enabled there to be government in the United States for decades, which is that you have to keep the show on the road, even if you disagree. And that's what, you know, we should remember, that until the Gingrich Revolution of 1994, as he called it, that big landslide win, Democrats controlled the House of Representatives for 40 years. Mm-hmm. Republicans were in a minority that long. Ingrained in them in that period was an idea that they could protest and they could argue, but in the end, the government had to continue. And Gingrich came along and upset that principle, and that's why that first shutdown happened. And now out of that has grown this Tea Party faction who believe it's more important to stand on principle than to, in the end, come together with some kind of consensus that enables the country to function. What I don't know is whether this defeat, and let's make no mistake, this is a defeat for the Republicans. They have got nothing from
will
this.
Is it a transparent defeat? Is everyone going to agree it's a defeat?
Well, you can never legislate for Fox News because they can tell you the moon is made of cheese, you know, so they could try and somehow spin this. But anybody else, John Boehner included, went to his local radio station and said, you know, we fought the good fight, but we lost. Right. And so this is a defeat for them. Obama gave not an inch. This will embolden him, also empower him with his liberals who feel he didn't have, in his first term, enough muscle, didn't stand up to them. This time he has. And you just wonder, could this be the high watermark of the Tea Party and from now on they recede as a faction, or do they get even crazier after this? And, you know, I don't know that.
Do you think, Martin, it's different from mid-90s, yeah, Gingrich? Has it changed since then, Republican Party? Or is it, as Johnny says, there was a Gingrich revolution and then they've stayed in that mould ever since? Or is it?
I think it's become more so. And the question Johnny poses is the right question. Does this defeat, and there was a similar standoff exactly at the beginning of this year, just before Obama's second inauguration, which had a similar outcome, where the proverbial can was kicked again down the proverbial road, as it has been now. The question is the question for the Republican Party. I think it's 144 of them in the House of Representatives voted against this deal. That's 144 pretty incorrigible figures at the end of the day who didn't want this compromise deal to go ahead and who would have pushed perhaps the whole ship over the debt default line. Now, those people have got to decide where their principal interest lies. They're all up for re-election in 2014, and because of the way that congressional districts are gerrymandered, they are representing groups of people who want them to do exactly what they have done and
so
bring the government.
They're focused on the primary election.
So they are
the
focused on
election.
Next year's re-election already. There are about 100 Republican congressmen, some of whom will face re-election challenges now as a result of having voted the way they did with the Democrats last night. So, I mean, you know, two things can be true at the same time in life, but it's both true that the Republicans are in a mess and therefore needing to change, and that they're not going to change because the pressures of the political cycle are going to exert their grip. And I think until America sorts out its congressional districting system, this is going to continue to be the case. And it will be interesting to see whether any moves take place along those lines. I mean, what I think British listeners in particular need to get their heads around about the US Congress is that the Democrats won the congressional election in 2012. They got more votes, a large number more votes than the Republicans. But because of the way in which the districts are allocated, because they're fixed by parties at state level, the Republicans were able to get a majority in the House. This House of Representatives is not representative of American opinion. And that, you know, in a way, is the problem, because I think Democrats are going to go on winning presidential elections, providing they don't put up absolutely idiotic candidates, for as far as the eye can see. Because in national elections, it seems to me there are demographic and political reasons why sensible Democrats are going to go on occupying the White House. And the real problem in America is how do the angry people on the right, of whom there are a lot, there's at least 40% of the electorate in America that seriously believes all this stuff, or at least is prepared to go on voting for it, and what do they do? And it's a really big existential question for them more than for anybody else.
And the more perfect union, the checks and balances, it's something the rest of the world has looked to and admired the rest of the time. But now with this sort of partisanship, is America any longer a, whatever the phrase is, shining city on the hill?
It's the question that we keep coming back to, isn't it? Actually, I was vox popped in Boston on my arrival.
On holiday?
On holiday. And my interviewer, I did what I thought was a fantastically fluent 45 seconds of how the rest of the world saw this kind of standoff. And I ended up by saying, shaking my head and saying, but, you know, people are saying, is this any way to run a country? And he turned on me and he said, you've come from England. You've come to take us back. But it's not a question that's just being asked now. It's become increasingly over the last 10 years, really, as you say, since the Gingrich revolution and since that sort of kind of willingness to disregard the greater good.
It's not just about budgets. And I mean, this is the thing that keeps coming back in these crisis points, sequestration and funding the debt and moving the debt ceiling and so on. But isn't there a broader issue here about whether the president's got credibility? He's meant to have responsibility for foreign policy. But if you're negotiating, I don't know, a trade policy or climate change, and the Congress won't give you any leeway to honour the deal, Johnny, then you're not really in charge of foreign policy anymore.
Well, that's true in a very specific mechanical way, which is that treaties have to be ratified by the Senate in particular. And so, for example, on climate change, people used to say it doesn't matter that Obama's got all the right kind of Guardian-friendly views on climate change. He would never get a treaty through the Senate. And, you know, you remember the Kyoto Treaty, I think it was defeated 98-2 or something, in the Senate. They have an actual role in foreign policy. The thing that I had conversations about this with various people involved, sort of foreign policy specialists, and they made a very interesting argument. First of all, there's the on-its-face view that America has become an unreliable ally. You know, if it can't sort out its own problems, how on earth can it sort out anybody else's? That it just seems flaky and dysfunctional. But the underneath that is a larger point, which is why have these problems come about? Why was the country taken to the brink of the abyss? And it was because of this faction, this Tea Party faction. Brief detour, how perfect that you were in Boston, which of course is, you know, the event that triggers and is looked to by the Tea Party. But this Tea Party faction, besides their obsession about, you know, shrinking the government domestically, there is a very wide streak, almost a defining streak of isolationism in that group of people who believe, why are we spending all this money on anything other than just here at home? You have this ascendancy of this Rand Paul, son of Ron Paul, who represents an overt isolationist politics. Capitals around the world are looking at that and thinking, if these guys are in the ascendant to the point where, as Martin said, they have the majority among House Republicans, how much should we bet on America being there for us? Because they're obviously withdrawing from the world, that faction. You know, somebody said, to put it to me, that if you're sitting in Manila or Tokyo or Seoul, you're thinking it's time to start hedging our bets and making sure we've got a good line into the Chinese, because America might not be there as the big regional superpower. I mean, that's a big change.
Even the Chinese are upset by what's happening on them, although they as you rightly say, in the kind of global, in a global sense, they stand to be the gainers from any American isolationism. They themselves are alarmed because of the condition of the world economy at what's going on in Washington.
Okay, that's all we've got time for. So thanks to Jonathan Friedland, to Anne Perkins and Martin Kettle. And thank you very much for listening.
Support for this Guardian podcast comes from Squarespace, providing creative tools that help you bring your ideas to life. Squarespace offers free domain names, customizable designs, drag-and-drop tools, and 24/7 support. Squarespace also offers seamless e-commerce solutions for you or your small business. Every design automatically includes a unique mobile experience that matches the overall style of your website, so your content will look brilliant on any device. Start your free trial today, no credit card required. As a Guardian podcast listener, you'll get 10% off your new account by using the offer code GUARDIAN.